Minehead Baptist Church Sermon Podcast for Sunday, the 8th of July, 2018. Hello and welcome. Thank you once again for joining me. My name's James and I'm the web guy here at NBC. This week we continued our series looking at faith through Nehemiah. The speaker this week was Steve Godfrey. He's a retired Baptist minister who's recently moved to the area. He was looking at keeping faith and it was from Nehemiah 6 verses 1 to 14. So let's go and join Steve as he's starting the sermon.
Well, I love preaching from Nehemiah, and I wonder if you've ever considered in your life which Bible character you most identify with. Have you been asked that question? Which character in the Bible do you think you are most like? Have you thought about that? Are there any courageous Joshuas here? Put your hands up for the courageous Joshuas among us. Oh dear, not none, okay. Right. How about a doubting Thomas? Oh, got one at the back. No. What about busy Marthas? Any busy Marthas among us? One at the front, two, three, four, okay. About impetuous Peters? It's obviously a question you don't think about. Mind you, where's James gone? Big James. He's disappeared. Jason's here, yeah. I reckon he's a bit like King David. You know why, don't you? Because King David's triumph was heard throughout the valley, so he must have been in motorbikes. Oh dear. Well, I think I'm a bit like Nehemiah, and I've in my ministry over the years, since ordination, I've been involved in three building projects in the last 15 years at least. I may not have a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other like Nehemiah, but people over the years have often joked about me as having a Bible in one hand and various Black & Decker tools in the other hand. And as you may have picked up over the last few weeks, Nehemiah was also a visionary. He captured a vision of what God wanted for his people. And I think in those two levels, I feel a little bit like Nehemiah. So, from the moment that Nehemiah heard of the terrible condition of the city walls of his homeland, God gave him a passion to evaluate, to cast the vision, and to organize working parties on repairing the walls of Jerusalem. In chapter 3, a few weeks ago, we read how that 41 separate working parties were getting on with each other and rebuilding the walls, involving, might I emphasize here, involving pretty well everybody and every type of trade. Men and women alike, ordinary people, even the perfume makers. I bet that was a steep learning curve, you know, building walls when you're used to making perfume. Mind you, I guess with everybody working quite close to each other or alongside each other in the heat, maybe the perfume makers did actually have some special skills they could bring to the situation. And so we're going to pick up the story in chapter 6, which I'm now going to read to you. So if you've got your pew Bibles, your chair Bibles, Nehemiah chapter 6, can I suggest the first person that finds it shouts out the page number? Do you have pew Bibles? You do. It might be on the screen. That's even better. Fantastic. All right. Wonderful. Okay, so Nehemiah chapter 6. When the word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the walls and not a gap was left in it, though at that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? 4 times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Then the 5th time, Sanballat sent his assistant to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king. And I've even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah." Now, this report will get back to the king, that's King Artaxerxes. "So come, let us confer together." I sent him this reply: "Nothing like you, what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed." I don't know if you've been following this series, but you noticed how many times we get that little phrase, you know, "I prayed," or "Nehemiah prays." It's probably about the 4th or 5th time this has happened now. "But I prayed, now strengthen my hands." Then when one day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. And he said, "Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night, they are coming to kill you." But I said, "Should a man like me run away? Or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go." I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and they would give me a bad name to discredit me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, oh my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me. I want to carry on just a few more verses into chapter 6. So the wall was completed in the 25th of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence, because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them, for many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, son of Arah, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshullam, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and then telling him what I had said. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. My first point this morning, if we have the PowerPoint up, is keep, today's sermon is called Keeping Faith. By the way, the pictures are just pictures I've just taken around where we live. That's why we like it. So this is Porlock. So if you get bored with the sermon, just look at the pretty pictures. Keep faithful in the ministry or passion that God has given you. You know, since this first group of exiles had returned to Jerusalem some 93 years earlier, under the inspiration of Isaiah and Haggai and Zechariah, these returning exiles had lost the vision. They'd lost their energy to rebuild the walls. They had compromised with their neighbors, and they'd settled into a lifestyle based on commerce that had no distinctive character. They were in attitude and in their spiritual life no different to those living around them. Friends, if our love for God, if our desire to see his kingdom come, if we desire folk to discover the amazing love of Jesus, we have to remain faithful to God without compromise. We have to be distinctive enough for people to look at us and recognize the authenticity of our lifestyle and our attitudes. Not least towards one another, but also to the poor. And we saw in chapter 5 that there was injustice, even among the so-called people of faith, the people of God, there was injustice. Rich Jews were selling their own people into slavery so that the rich became richer and the poor became poorer. And this was forbidden by God. So there's compromise and the copying of worldly values amongst God's people. And of course, when that happens, you lose vision, you lose your passion, and your faith becomes lukewarm. Our God is a God of justice. He cares for the poor, the widows, the orphans, etc. And if our faith is to remain active and vibrant, so we must have a passion for the things that God is passionate about too. But God wanted also these people to have a center of worship, a place that was a beacon of light, if you like, among the neighbors. A place where worship was central and fellowship. And I think it's nothing short of a miracle that after the Babylonians had taken the Jewish people into exile, only a matter of 50 or 60 years later, under the King Cyrus, in year 537 BC, that they were given permission to go back and re-establish the worship of God. As I said earlier, after that initial burst of enthusiasm, they had lost the plot. But Nehemiah caught that vision again. And God even arranged for him to have time off as cupbearer to the king to go and realize that vision and to rebuild. Friends, churches need vision. Where there is no vision, you can probably say the rest of the text, the people perish. And this is where I again identified a little bit with Nehemiah. When I left Spurgeon's College back in 1992, I used to be an engineer, by the way. I left school in 1976, became a technical officer for British Telecommunications, and had a career in telecommunications, which is why I've always had an interest in things electrical and what have you. It's why I can rewire my house legally. and we in our first church, we went to Plymouth. The chapel was small, and the village had three pubs. And none of these pubs were doing particularly well. The biggest of the three went out of business. and several of us in the church caught a vision to relocate and renovate this pub building. We had a vision for three sheltered units of accommodation upstairs and a large and medium-sized meeting room downstairs with kitchens and an office. But opposition quickly came, mainly, would you believe, from within the church. This is the scary bit. One church member, I remember to this day, one church member said to me, "Young man, if you so much as lay a finger on this building, my ancestors will come and haunt you." I was only 3 years out of college, still in my probationary period. I mean, how do you deal with a white witch in your congregation? Well, this is Cornwall and Devon for you. It's a bit beyond the time standard. No, I won't say that. So in the first 3 years of leaving college, I kid you not, I faced a hostile gathering one Tuesday night in the local community, whipped up by a handful of people in my own church who did not want to move out of the old chapel. That sounds like Nehemiah's problem to me, very similar. And we lost the opportunity. The pub was pulled down, and the site was developed for housing, and today the chapel is still limited by its cramped premises. Sad, isn't it? Now, Sanballat was the governor of Samaria. He probably worshipped the God of Israel. His son's name are based on the God's name Yahweh. And one of his daughters married Jehoiada, son of the high priest. So Tobiah also means God is good. And again, he has strong ties with the priesthood in Jerusalem. So these people opposing Nehemiah, opposing the vision that God has given his people, are basically believers. This is the scary thing about it. It is often the case, you've even got to read a bit about church history, it is often the case that sometimes the greatest opposition to the church's growth comes from within rather than without, and those on the fringe of church life. Sadly, and this is an admission which I don't often make, but every church where I've been pastor, I've lost some church members. It's not because I'm like Marmite. Also, some people say I am, but anyway, that's another story. But you know, some folks in the churches I've led wanted to remain in the church as it was. They want the church to stay as they are used to it. They don't want change. And some wanted the church to, some could only see the church growth through a particular style of preaching or a particular style of worship. One person once said to me, "What we need is a drummer and bass guitar, and that will sort it all out." That is rubbish. Some people wanted to see the premises develop with a focus on seats. Seats in rows, like you've got here, dare I say, and a pulpit. You know, a place where people could come and hear the word of the Lord preached. Or a place where you could come to seeker events and hear the gospel. Very 1980s, 1970s model of being church. And for those of us who have taken time out, as I did a few years ago, to study church growth, you will know that we have seen a massive shift in the way churches grow today. In the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a huge shift in the way people become engaged with church and become Christians.
And that seeker model, where people are invited to come over your threshold in order to hear about Jesus, it's over. It worked in Willow Creek, it's worked in seeker services, it worked even in this country in the 1980s and 90s, but it doesn't work anymore. We have to be radically different as church if the church is going to grow and people are going to come to faith. Glad to say that my previous church in Guildford today doesn't look like a church even. It's a community centre. And the downstairs was not developed with rows and pulpits. It's a big coffee shop. And 2,000 people a week go through that building now with opportunity for many of them to actually now start to hear about Jesus. And people walk into the cafe and say, "What is it about this place that is so different?" And there are churches all around the country. And I can, if you want to know websites, you can read about, go on and you can read about it, where churches are just doing things differently. We call it fresh expressions, if you like. And people are coming to faith because they've abandoned the old-fashioned models of being church. You've got it here to a large degree, I think. I've been to the Hub. I'm very impressed with the Hub. I'm impressed with the passion that you have as a church for that centre. Don't let anything derail it. Stick at it and develop it. I'm sure Nehemiah would if he was alive today. At a personal level, some of you, so I'm just briefly about church. Let's just narrow this down a little bit now to you at a personal level, individual. At a personal level, some of you have had a vision or a desire planted in your heart, maybe for a particular ministry. Maybe to work with youth or the elderly or the homeless. Maybe to exercise some spiritual gifts like healing. Ask yourself this morning, what makes you weep as Nehemiah wept? What makes you feel deeply? What gives you a passion? And maybe over the years, opposition, a lack of support around you, whatever, it's caused you to lose that passion, and desire has faded. If that's you this morning, you know you had a passion, you know that God had called you to a particular ministry, and you've somehow let it go, I want you this morning to respond to God after this sermon and to whip into flame the gift that God gave you. If you can look back to a time when you had a passion for what God could do through you, I'm encouraging you today to revisit it. Make a commitment to chat and pray with trustworthy friends who can discern with you whether or not it's just your fanciful dreaming or whether God is in fact calling you to keeping faith for the task that is planted in your heart. That was a long first point. Second and third points are much quicker. So be discerning. Check it out with others. Right, second point. Keeping faithful when misrepresented and distracted. So, going back to our passage. When Sanballat and Tobiah and now Gershom the Arabs saw that the walls were now rebuilt, they tried misrepresenting and distracting Nehemiah. So the previous chapters, we've read how they've used mockery and false accusation and ridiculed. This hasn't worked. So now they try another method. Come, they say. Verse 2, come, let us meet together. And so we pick up in verse 3 and 4. And Nehemiah replies, I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down and chat with you guys? And in the end, Sanballat sent an open letter that everyone could read, in which Nehemiah is accused of conspiracy against King Artaxerxes, king of the old area. Friends, it is rare, very rare, for God's work to go unopposed. Jesus, the most perfect person who ever lived, had his critics. Taunts, physical threats. But Jesus was not defeated. He kept his vision. He kept focused on his calling. John chapter 15 reads, "If you belong to the world will love you as its own. Because you do not belong to this world, but I have chosen you out of this world, for therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, servants are not greater than their master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil things against you falsely on my account." Yeah, Nehemiah and Jesus had similar experiences, and so will we. So what does Nehemiah do? What does Nehemiah do with all these accusations and so on? Well, it's simple, really. He just denies it. He just gets on with the job. He doesn't get into a fluster and say, "Well, I'm going to talk to my solicitor and take out litigation against you and sort of this sort of stuff." Nothing like that. He simply denies it, recognizes it as yet another attempt to frighten them from getting on with fulfilling the vision God has given them. And he prays. Verse 9, he prays. "Strengthen my hands." I wonder if you've ever been misrepresented at work or in your family because of your beliefs. I wonder. I want to encourage you. Stick at it. Stay faithful to what God has given you. Don't let the world, don't even let your family take away that passion, that flame, that faith that God has given you. As I said earlier, back in the 1970s and 80s, I had a career in telecommunications as a technical officer. And I know what it's like to be misinterpreted, misrepresented, sorry, and accused of all sorts of things behind my back because I'm a Christian. Working in a secular environment, I know, is not easy. Sometimes our hopes of being salt and light to those around us can dissolve into just keeping our head down and not ever talking about our faith in Jesus. But remember one guy. I was 18 years old at the time, 17. One guy gave me such a hard time. Really hard time at work. And yet, many years later, after Anne and I were married, this guy became a Christian. And he moved into the house next to where my parents live, or lived in those days. And one day, he actually came round to my parents and apologized for the way he treated me several years earlier. And although I never personally shared the gospel directly with him, apparently, and I take no credit for this at all, apparently, there was some small thing that had an impact on him. And it helped him in his journey towards Jesus. Friends, if you're misrepresented or distracted from your faith at work, stay faithful. You just never know what little thing may happen through your faithfulness that has an impact on somebody else's journey towards Jesus. Stay faithful. But the distractions away from the vision can come in the guise of something more spiritual. And this is where it gets really tricky. This is on slightly more dangerous ground. Shemaiah has a long prophetic heritage. We get this in verse 10. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah. Now we know from the name that, and all the parts of the Old Testament, that his family was a family of a prophetic tradition. And he says something to Naaman. He says, "Let us meet in the house of God. Let us meet inside the temple." Now, this was a critical time for Nehemiah. The doors of the city walls are about to be hung, which will at last make Jerusalem, the city, secure. And these opponents, Tobiah, who was sort of like the guy who was governor of the sort of Ammon, or the part on the sort of the east side of the River Jordan, and then you've got Gershom, who was governor for the southern area going down towards Egypt, and you've got Sanballat, who was governor of Samaria to the north, and over also at that stage, at that time, over towards the Mediterranean Sea. So these three opponents actually are governors for the complete surrounding area, and this prophet comes and says, "Look, these people are going to kill you. Let's go and meet with God in the temple enclosure." Sounds plausible, doesn't it? Sounds like something that you might think, you know, it's not a bad idea. To go and escape from the surrounding conspirators. This must have sounded plausible. It would be like someone offering to take me on a place of pilgrimage, just as I'm purchasing and fitting some of the equipment in one of the church buildings projects that I've been sort of supervising or keeping an eye on. It never happened, thankfully, but what if it had? You know, just that critical moment when 3 or 4 weeks away from opening, one of my folks comes to me and says, "Stephen, I think we need to go for a week's prayer somewhere." What would I have done? Sounds so plausible, doesn't it? This man was a false prophet. And this is the issue. Friends, churches and individuals, occasionally we encounter a false prophet. And I've met a few in my time. A few people who have come into the church and have said, "You know what the problem with this church is? Oh yeah, I've hardly seen you before. You're going to tell me all about what's wrong with my church. By the way, there's a book that nearly got into the Bible called the Didache. It was one of those at that time when we were sort of deciding what was in the Bible and what was out of the Bible. The Didache was sort of one of those books that nearly got in. But there's a whole section in the Didache about how you deal with false visiting prophets who come to your church and tell you what's wrong with you and what to do with them. Listen, when you've spent hours in prayer, and all my churches have spent hours in prayer listening to God and discerning what the vision is, as a leader, it's not my job to catch that vision. Get this right. There are those who believe that, you know, as a pastor, you're meant to go up the mountain, come back and tell the church what they've got to do. Rubbish! Don't ever go there. It's dangerous, and churches sometimes go off rail because of that. Because get it wrong. We're Baptists. And the unique thing about a Baptist church, actually, is not our mode of baptism. Just read Beasley Murray, all the Baptist Union documents and pamphlets. You can download them. The unique thing, the specialness about being a Baptist is the way we discern and hear God speak to us and capture the vision for what he wants us to do. And it's not through the minister, it's through you. The job of the minister is only to facilitate that process and get it going and make sure it happens. And our churches, the churches where we're led, they've all, it's been the prayer meetings, it's been the church meetings where we've captured and caught the vision for the building projects. My job is just to make it happen or enable it to happen. So what happens when someone comes along and distracts and suggests something different to what you as a church have already discerned? You ignore it. And you stick with what God has laid on your hearts as a fellowship. And if you've got a passion for the hub, if you've got a passion to develop this place, stick with it. And no matter who comes along and tries to derail you, stick with what God has given you. It's so important. And let the fruit come. With this false prophet, what does Nehemiah do? Again, he prays. Verse 12, he prays again. And then we get the good news. So in verse 15, this is my final point. It's very quick now. Good news is the wall is completed in 52 days. Keep faithful when others appear to be doing better than you. You see, Tobiah, we pick that up in verse 19. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good works and then telling him what I had said. Tobiah obviously copied what Nehemiah had done earlier in actually looking after the poor and getting on with some of the social stuff that Nehemiah instigated. And there'll be times when those outside the church appear to be doing our job and doing a better job than what we do. And we could get discouraged. Look back over the history of the United Kingdom. You know, the many reforms in this country, abolition of slavery, free schooling for children, hospitals, make poverty history. All of these things have their roots in a desire planted amongst God's people for the kingdom of God. And the church got on with it, and society has caught the vision, and then they got on with it. So Tobiah, one of the opponents, probably was looking after the poor and running community projects and earning himself a good reputation. But it didn't stop Nehemiah from persevering with the vision God had given his people. It wasn't an excuse to stop. In fact, it was just an excuse, if anything, for Nehemiah to go on into chapter 7 to appoint worship leaders, to appoint gatekeepers, and to the next stage of the story. Ezra comes along in chapter 8, reads God's word, and people are renewed and invigorated through worship. So, friends, may faith and vision and passion be with you today. May Minor Baptist Church grow and be renewed. May you as individuals have faith and renewed passion and vigor. And for those of you who are feeling that you've lost your sense of call and passion for God, and for what God has laid on your hearts, I want to pray for you this morning that God will fan into flame the gift that God has given you. Amen.
To leave a comment on the sermon, please go to minehead-baptist.com/sermons. Well, thank you once again for listening, and I'll speak to you soon.